After decades of women fighting, marching, and protesting for the right to vote, in June of 1919, 100 years ago, the United States Congress passed the 19th Amendment, giving women that right. But as you know, when it comes to a constitutional amendment, that's only the first big hurdle. A majority of the states then had to ratify the amendment, one legislature at a time. That finally happened in August of 1920. Today, women are the largest single voting bloc in the United States. One of the important forces that made that amendment possible was the effort of women journalists who were still second-class citizens in many ways. My great-great-aunt, Miriam Michelson, was one of those tireless women journalists. I recently produced and moderated an event at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. about this centennial with top political journalists and the author of a new book about Aunt Miriam and the role of women journalists in this fight. We also talked about the impact of the powerful women's vote in the upcoming 2020 election. It was such a vibrant and fascinating discussion that we decided to publish the soundtrack from that event for you, our podcast listeners, as well. You can watch the video on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com. Thanks for listening, and as always, feel free to tweet me your comments and ideas at Joan Michelson.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Newseum's Walter and Leonora Annenberg Theater. I'm Jan Newharth, Chair and Chief Executive Officer of the Freedom Forum. We are so pleased to be partnering tonight with Politico's Women Rule as we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed American women the right to vote. This historic moment came after decades of struggle and protest by those who used their First Amendment rights to fight for change. In the Newseum's First Amendment Gallery, we tell the story of how the public can change the nation's laws through petition, one of the five freedoms of the First Amendment, and even change the Constitution itself. In 1848, 32-year-old Elizabeth Cady Stanton urged a convention in Seneca Falls, New York, to organize and petition for the right of women to vote. 72 years later, in 1920, the 19th Amendment was ratified, guaranteeing women the right to vote. Walk through any of our exhibits and you'll hear the stories of other women who have broken boundaries in broadcast, digital, and print journalism throughout history, including pioneering female journalists like Nellie Bly, Ida B. Wells, Helen Thomas, and Barbara Walters. And we will discuss another boundary-breaking journalist tonight. Tonight's program was produced by Joan Michelson, host of the Green Connections radio podcast, and we thank Joan for her hard work and dedication in putting tonight's program together. Joan will also be our moderator tonight. She is an award-winning business leader, journalist, coach, and advocate for women. She currently writes for Forbes, and she has worked with The Huffington Post, TheAtlantic.com, The New Economy, CBS News' 60 Minutes, ABC News, and many other media outlets. Her great-great-aunt was Miriam Michelson, a reporter who kept the suffrage cause in the headlines and whose story illustrates the critical role that women journalists played in helping women win the right to vote. We have an all-star panel lined up for you tonight to discuss this crucial turning point in American history, as well as women and the media. I want to welcome all of you here tonight and again thank Politico's Women Rule for partnering with us tonight. And as always, I'd like to thank our Newseum members and friends of the First Amendment Society whose continuing support makes programs like this one tonight possible. It is now my pleasure to introduce Joan Michelson, who will introduce our panel.
Thank you, Jan, for that gracious introduction. That's very sweet. And thank you for hosting us here at the Newseum and for what the Newseum does for the First Amendment. And thank you all for being here for this important event. We all know, especially this year, how important it is that women have the right to vote, right? You think, maybe? So first, I'd like to thank Kathy Trost, who, when I first approached her about 2 years ago about commemorating the 19th Amendment, latched onto the idea and approaching it from the angle of women journalists, because so many people talk about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Lucretia Mott and others. But women journalists played a huge role, as you'll discover tonight. I'd also like to thank John Menard of the museum, who is not here tonight, but who worked tirelessly with me, tolerating my attention to ridiculous details, I must add. And I'd also like to thank Elizabeth Dixon of the museum for her help in bringing tonight to reality as well. 6 years ago, I got a random email that said the following words in a subject window: "Research on Miriam Michelson." Since it was my last name, I thought I should open it. As I read, I realized that this person was writing a book about my great-great-aunt, one of the female journalists of the late 1800s and early 1900s, who I knew essentially nothing about. Previously, I had only heard, read in biographies of her famous brother, Albert Michelson, who was a Nobel laureate scientist, that he had a sister who liked to write. Yeah, do you think maybe? I quickly realized I needed to reach out to this person and learn more about Miriam Michelson, especially as a journalist myself. I wanted to learn what role she played in moving the suffrage movement forward, and as both a journalist and as a best-selling fiction writer, which you'll hear about tonight. We really don't hear about women journalists taking a role in this, right? And so we wanted to make sure in covering the history of the 19th Amendment that we did, that we addressed the role. And you'll hear about it tonight, and you'll probably be surprised at the role. So I'm very excited to address this issue today and to commemorate this important historic achievement. I believe women getting the right to vote was the gateway to women getting economic, social, and political power. Today, there are accomplished women in state houses, courthouses, boardrooms, newsrooms, executive suites, among other places, who would not have those jobs without the 19th Amendment. Frankly, the women in this audience, and myself included, would not have the privileges and the opportunities that we have without the right to vote. So tonight we're going to talk about the impact of women journalists on getting the right to vote. We're going to talk about women journalists today who cover politics and about women voters, including their important role in 2020. Obviously, I think you know in this audience that women are the largest voting bloc in the country. So we hold the power, ladies. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce the powerhouse women who are going to discuss this with us today. The person who sent me that random email 6 years ago and who graciously asked me to write the foreword to her book about Miriam Michelson is Dr. Lori Harrison Kahn. Lori is a professor of English at Boston College who specializes in American literature and culture with a focus on women's writing. A fun fact about Lori is that she interviewed Toni Morrison after Morrison won the Nobel Prize in Literature, and it converted Lori, believe it or not, from being a journalist to going to get her PhD in English. I think I would have gone the other way, but there we go. Lori? We're going to be talking about the book, of course, and you can buy the book tonight at the bookstore and all evening. In fact, I think it's going to be open. And immediately following our discussion, we're going to have a book signing up there as well. Anna Palmer is co-author of the Politico Playbook, which leads the political coverage of the day every day. You hear it quoted constantly. She's editorial director of Politico's Women Rule initiatives and their terrific annual summit. If you haven't gone, you should. She's also the co-author of the best-selling book, The Hill to Die On, The Battle of Congress and the Future of Trump's America. How she found time to write a book, I have no clue. We are also grateful for Politico's support of this event tonight. A fun fact about Anna is that she grew up on a farm in North Dakota. And she found out tonight that I actually lived in North Dakota for 3.5 years. So welcome. Please welcome Anna Palmer. And Shauna Thomas is the Emmy Award-winning Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of Vice News, which is reinventing news coverage Prior to joining Vice News, Shauna was senior producer and senior digital editor of the iconic NBC News program Meet the Press. We've probably heard of that, don't you think? A fun fact about Shauna is that she went to high school with Beyonce. I think I'm envious of that experience. I promise I won't tell you how much she sold her yearbook for, though. Shauna, come join us. And we'll play musical chairs before we start. So we're going to start with a historical perspective. Oh, yeah, I have the clicker. Okay. Isn't that a cool picture? By the way, that was taken by a woman. Yes, there were female photojournalists at the time. Go figure that one out.
We know how to use cameras?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Isn't that a shock?
I know, it's crazy.
I know. So, Lori, what role did we see this picture of editors, women editors and journalists marching for the movement? What role did women journalists play specifically in the suffrage movement?
Sure. So I think there's been a lot of discussion with the Centennial about the relationship between suffrage and the media. And there's a couple of ways that that gets talked about. One of them is the way that suffragists created spectacles, parades like you're seeing here, rallies, other events that then the media would be forced to cover.
Something's never changed.
Huh? Right, exactly. And then there were also suffrage journals like the Women's Citizen that were published that would spread the news about the movement. But I was interested in another question, and that question was, what role did female journalists play in the mainstream press in terms of spreading the word about the suffrage movement? Of course, this is long before Facebook and Twitter, so in order to find out where a rally or convention or a speech was taking place, people would turn to their newspapers, their daily newspapers.
So that was one way.
Right. They actually read a newspaper. So that was one way that female journalists would spread the word. But when I began to look at those newspapers and look at the role of female journalists, what I realized that there was more going on than the logistics of when and where, that women journalists also became role models and inspirations for other women. And this happened because it was such a big deal. This is, we're talking about the 1890s here, when women are first entering the field of journalism. And it was so unusual to have a woman journalist that a lot of attention was being drawn to the fact that a woman was reporting on the suffrage movement. And those women, like Miriam Michelson, who began reporting on the suffrage movement, would themselves become a model for the women readers. That women would read this and see that a woman could take a role in public life beyond the domestic sphere, and they could follow the adventures of these female journalists who were reporting on various events. And someone like Michelson, this is also a time, I should say, when women really did not go out in public unchaperoned. And here she was as a journalist traveling to Hawaii. She was based in San Francisco, traveling Hawaii on her own to report on the anti-annexation movement, or exploring Chinatown in San Francisco in search of a story. And there's one other component that I want to mention to this as well in terms of women serving as models. Michelson, we should use the term Miriam, so it wasn't confused her with you. So Miriam was a single woman. And so not only did you have a role model, a woman as role model, but you had a model of a single woman who was earning her own living here before you in the pages of the daily paper. And one of the most common arguments that anti-suffragists put forward against suffrage for women was that women didn't need the vote because they had the vote through their husbands. They were already represented. So, of course, a single woman gave the lie to that claim.
Okay, I heard a groan.
By the suffragists, the anti-suffragists. Yeah. And this was also a moment in history where more and more women were opting out of marriage and childbearing.
The other thing that you've told me that I think may have been an inspiration, too, was that she actually had her own byline.
That's right. Right.
So talk about that. That was unusual. That was like part of the spectacle.
Right.
So but to me, that also says that women were learning to own it, if you will, to stand up for yourself and to claim what you did and to have your name on something professional.
Right. Well, I think it's also important, unlike today, most newspaper articles in the 1890s did not have bylines. They were unsigned articles. You would just be a reporter for the paper. You weren't necessarily known. When women reporters, and this really started with Nellie Bly, who Jan mentioned, when women reporters started working for papers, they were given bylines. And that was part of the spectacle. It was so unusual for women to be reporting that the papers wanted to draw attention to the fact that they had a female reporter. Women were also very likely to get on the front page with their bylines for that reason. So maybe should we look at the next? Do we have a slide?
You want to go to the next slide?
So yes, you can see this, control. Right? So these are some of, on one side you're seeing here, viewed by a woman. This is one of Miriam Michelson's earliest articles. She's covering a women's suffrage convention in California. And you can see in this case, her name is in the, actually not just the byline, the sub-headline of the article. So often women reporters, they weren't just reporting the news, they were really becoming the news, right? There were two levels here. One was the level of the story that was being reported. The other part of the story was the very fact that a woman reporter was reporting the news. So this got a lot of attention. Not only did they have bylines, but sometimes their pictures would appear with the article. This wasn't a column.
Yeah, we have
it was
that
a news
in
story.
The next...
Do we have one of those as well?
That goes
here. You can see this is actually Miriam's first front page news story for the San Francisco Call. And you could see her name is in the sub headline here. And this is the image that appeared with the article as well.
Yeah, we didn't blow the picture up. That's actually the size of the picture. You also, she actually covered the movement directly. So you talk a little bit about the California Women's Conference and also Congress, and she was also one of the foremost interviewers of Susan B. Anthony.
That's right, right.
So how did those come about?
Right. So she got her start. Well, so the one thing, just to backtrack a little bit historically, is that women did write for newspapers in the 19th century, but they wrote for a particular page of the newspaper, which was called the Woman's Page and labeled as the Woman's Page. It was kind of assumed that women were only interested on news on that page, and that it wasn't really news. It was really just fashion and society events. Then reporters like Miriam really resisted writing for the Woman's Page. And the way that Miriam got her start covering stories was by writing about the suffrage movement. So she covered a suffrage convention in San Francisco, where she was based. She did several interviews with Susan B. Anthony, as well as other famous suffrage leaders. That was the beginning of her career. But what I find really interesting is that she refused to be pigeonholed. So even though she began by covering the suffrage movement, she very quickly moved into other arenas. And so very soon after she started, you could see from this article that's up here, where she's covering the anti-annexation movement in Hawaii. So she's moving away from suffrage very quickly. She wrote about crime, politics, sports. She even covered collegiate women's sports, which I find fascinating.
Oh, wow.
She's getting women athletes into the news as well.
Cool. Yeah, I think you told me just as a quick story that she... I think it was with Hawaii where she needed an escort, but she ditched the escort. Oh, that was in one of her fictions. She ditched the escort. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that Miriam did, you mentioned before that she was a best-selling fiction writer. In fact, when her brother won the Nobel Prize, she was better known, and he was introduced as Miriam's brother. He had a sister who liked to write. Okay, don't get me started on that one. But talk about, she used her fiction as a tool to empower women.
That's right. So I think she turned to fiction. She spent about 7 years as a journalist in San Francisco and then Philadelphia. And she turned to fiction. I think one of the reasons that she turned to fiction is because she realized that she could have a national audience. With newspapers, you have a pretty local audience, right? She was a celebrity in San Francisco and then wrote for a brief time in Philadelphia. But she began writing for some of the most popular magazines of her day. They were publishing her fiction, and the Saturday Evening Post is a good example. She also wrote for The Smart Set, which was a precursor to The New Yorker. And initially, when she started her career as a fiction writer, she drew from her experience as a journalist. So she published a series called The Yellow Journalist that focused on a female reporter in the age of Hearst and Pulitzer. She uses the term a girl reporter. And this series appeared in the Saturday Evening Post in 1905. Around that time, she became a best-selling author as well with a novel called In the Bishop's Carriage.
That's this one, right?
No, so this is The Milpitas Maiden.
No, I mean The Saturday Evening Post.
The Saturday
cover.
Evening Post was The Yellow Journalist,
yeah.
And this was The Milpitas Maiden, which is one installment in that series in which the fictional character covers a suffrage convention. But also in fiction, she also refused to be pigeonholed. So very quickly, she's playing with other genres. And one of the genres that she plays with is science fiction. And this is where the title story of my collection comes from, The Superwoman. The Superwoman was...
This is 1912.
In 1912, she publishes the title novella in The Smart Set called The Superwoman, which takes place on an Amazonian island on which women rule. And it was actually a source text for the Wonder Woman comics. So if you think about the role of Paradise Island in Wonder Woman, that came from Miriam's story, The Superwoman.
And it goes with the Politico initiative called Women Rule as well.
Right, exactly.
Perfect segue. So Anna and Shauna, talk about, this is such an interesting evolution, right? You can see how we got from there to hear. But talk about, first of all, if you have any other questions for Lori, we're happy to entertain those. But also, I want to talk about the state of women journalists today, especially those who cover politics. I found some really annoying statistics. Okay, I'm just being blunt here. The Women's Media Center, 2019, okay, men receive 63% of the bylines and other credits in print, internet, TV, and wire news. Women get 37%. This is 2019. When it comes to reporting on politics, it's worse, present company excluded. Print is 66% male, 34% female. Women still lead, you'll be happy to know, in lifestyle, health, and leisure. Society pages take a die slowly. Of the mainstream media, anchors, correspondents, and reporters, PBS is 64% male, 63% female. I could go on. New York Times is 67% male, 33% female. The only one that's 50-50 ones are MSNBC and Huffington Post, HuffPost as it goes by now. The wires, where most reporters and editors get the stories they follow up on, by the way, are 70% male decision makers, except for these fabulous women. And it gets worse if you look at editors, managers, staff overall, and people of color. So, Anna, talk about, you just wrote this great book, too, on the elections. Talk about your experience as a female journalist, especially covering politics.
Yeah, so I mean, this number surprised me a little bit. I actually was in a meeting today at Politico, and I'm proud to, in contrast, say that Politico is 52% female.
Cool.
Which is a big change and an intentional shift, I would say, as a publication was started by all white men. And so I think we've, in the 12 years, have really made, particularly in the last several, a big effort in making sure that we're intentional in our hiring in a variety of different ways, but partly looking at gender for sure and gender representation. I've been covering politics in D.C. for over 15 years. I started covering lobbying, which is basically, you know, old white dudes who had a lot more power and a lot more influence than I did. I was coming from North Dakota, as Joan said, with bleach blonde hair and a nose ring and some waitress shoes in case it all didn't work out. Thankfully, I'm here today, so it's worked out. But yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, you know, my own experience, I can't speak for everyone's experience. But I would say my experience covering politics largely, although we've seen such a shift in this last election, was covering, you know, men for the most part in Congress, right? Particularly in the Senate. A lot of the operatives, the people that you kind of deal with as sources on the day-to-day were men. But I never, there's certain instances, of course, in everybody's, you know, own life. But I mean, I really felt like the Capitol Hill in particular is a kind of this weird community of people that spend hours and hours and hours of time, you know, in the basement of the Capitol waiting to get members of Congress. And you kind of, there's a real relationship that forms, I think, in the sense of just seeing everybody day in and day out through a lot of crises and through a lot of, you know, kind of really critical times in history. So I don't know if that answers your question in the right way of what you're looking for, but I don't know, you know, I didn't feel like I couldn't cover what I wanted to cover. Right. I covered lobbying, you know, largely because no one else wanted to cover it, and it was my way in. And then through that, have been given a lot of opportunities from covering Nancy Pelosi's first speakership to now I'm the first woman to write one of the national, you know, newsletters, a daily basis, a Politico playbook that goes out every single day.
Yeah, I think for me, I would say one of the things about being a woman journalist, especially in like the TV news world, and I'm while on Vice News Tonight, I am a part-time correspondent. I was a producer at NBC for many years. My real job is senior producer of Vice News Tonight on HBO, as well as the DC bureau chief. And there is a theory that I am the first black female DC bureau chief in Washington for a news organization that many of you have never heard of, but that's neither here nor there. But what I will say is that at NBC, there were women in a couple of key positions that definitely gave me an opportunity that I'm not even sure, like, they should have given me at the time. There was a woman named Naomi Karam who was in charge of the politics desk and the politics coverage for the 2008 election, because at that time, NBC, like, started a whole new assignment desk, and they did it out of New York instead of DC for some other reason that I still to this day don't understand, but that's fine. And I was a news associate, which is a very entry-level position at NBC News, and worked on the desk for a little bit, And she saw me and she was like, I think you can do this. I think you can help like run our 2008 coverage. And I already had a love for politics. My undergraduate degree is in political communication. I had worked as a lobbyist, being the only black woman in a room with a bunch of white men for a few years after I was in college. But she gave me an opportunity and she saw something. And it's not that men don't see that. I just don't know if they think the same way. No offense to all of you men in this audience who are encouraging lots of women, as you should be, and I know that. But I do think she saw me, she saw an opportunity, and then I worked my butt off for the next year and a half, and I was managing the embeds and like knowing where the candidates would go. And it was this very logistical job, but it allowed me to learn, and I think she knew this because she had been at the company for so long, it allowed me to learn about everybody
That's
in the company.
What I was thinking,
yeah. It allowed me to learn how NBC News worked. I got to know the sat ops people. I got to know the crew people. I got to know the rest of the assignment desk. I got to know the people who ran the shows, which is sort of separate than how the assignment desk works. And that was a launching point. And I credit her with that. I also will say, I mean, I had watched Tim Russert as a child. Working for Meet the Press was a dream for me. I did get to do it briefly with Tim before he passed, but also got to help create the newest iteration with Chuck Todd. But the senior digital editor part of my job was created by a woman who was in a vice presidential, who had a VP title. And it was one of those situations where I was the White House producer and covering Obama, and that was great. And they were like, you should go do this. And I was like, well, you know, being a White House producer, like, you get to go around the world, you get to fly on Air Force One, it's not that bad. And she's like, no, really, you should do this. And what she was saying to me was, see the opportunity, go take it, run with it. Mm-hmm. And then I was allowed to run with it at Meet the Press. And so what I would say is that there have been some key women in my life who have given me opportunities that I just think that it takes having women in those roles to sort of see and create that situation. And that's kind of what I try to do with my staff as well.
Well, it almost sounds like they saw things in you that maybe you didn't even see in yourself at the time.
Or that I didn't know I could do.
And they didn't know you could do. Yeah.
That's
like
an inherently female, oftentimes, trait, right? Where you have the second guessing in your head. I mean, I think what's so like amazing when you look at what Miriam was doing and how bold she was, and to say, you know, I'm not just going to be in the fashion pages, or I'm not just going to be, you know, on the front page. Like, she kept striving. And I think so often when either given an opportunity or when, you know, for me, when Playbook opened up 3 years ago, I mean, I was going around, you know, talking to everybody, all my friends, my mom, oh, I don't know if I can do this, whatever. And my mom finally just being like, if you were a man, you would not even think this. You would say, of course I can do this.
Exactly.
And so, you know, you just have to, I think that's what's so interesting about her is how she clearly, like, took the ring and went for it.
She didn't let it get in her way either.
Yeah. And I think it's our job as sort of leaders in our newsrooms to tell other women, it's not that you have to think like a man, but you have to, like, get over some of the girl stuff that goes on in your head.
Right.
That you have to say, you know what, I can do that.
Do you think that women ask different questions or cover issues differently? I mean, Lori has written about this, and that Miriam did that to a degree. I think I do, personally. But in your experience in covering politics specifically, do you find that women journalists or women producers or editors look at things through maybe it's a different prism, or they, you know, flip it over and turn it purple or something? Do you think there's any difference?
I think everybody comes to a story from their own vantage point, right? I think I look at stories very differently because I grew up in a rural town in North Dakota.
Yeah, right.
You know, that is very different than a lot of people and most people that I work with who grew up in big cities and went to, you know, private school or different, you know, you come at things from very different vantage point. I think that some of the stories I'm interested in, right? I was very interested in military sex assault before, you know, several years ago, and Politico gave me the latitude to spend basically 6 months doing series before it kind of became this national phenomenon that everybody decided to, in a great way, to take on, particularly on the Hill. But so I don't know that I found that interesting in a lot of different ways, but I don't know that my male colleagues were, you know, jumping to do those, cut that story. But I don't know in the day-to-day, like, you know, kind of daily story, if you're just because you're female, you're going to write a different story.
I think in television, the way it manifests itself is, are things like MOSs, which we call man on the street interviews, right? Like, who are you trying to talk to at a voter event or something like that? When we're out in Iowa and you want to like see how people responded to something very specific a candidate said, are you only talking to white men? And I think I think male producers in television now know they need to have a cross section, but I think who you talk to and who you target and how you visually want the piece to be, and you want to try to have a cross-section that is somewhat representative of the world that you know, that's when, in some ways, I think woman brain and Black person brain and also girl who grew up in the South brain mm-hmm. sort of kicks in, and you're like, okay, we can't just, I know we just talked to like five guys. We have to now spend some time looking for women who are willing to talk to us and convincing them to talk to us because their point of view is just as valid as the other point of view. I think I do think about the balance in pieces a lot more. Mm-hmm. I think it manifests itself in ways that I think a man could see as, like, I'm being a little bit sexist. I mean, I had a conversation today for a piece that I'm going to try to do tomorrow. We were talking about what kind of expert do we want to talk to? And sometimes I'm like, go find me a woman. Or I'm going to go find me a woman. Like, that becomes very, very important, so it's not the same people talking all the time. I do think I make some choices a little differently than I would otherwise.
And it takes a little more effort, you know.
What There's an intentionality.
Intentionality. And sometimes you have to go below the sea level. I mean, we're also trained to get to, you know, the top person. Well, the top person is usually a white guy, with all due respect. And so if you want the diversity, you have to search a little harder. I also find sometimes I get women who self-cancel. They go, oh, well, I'm not ready, or oh, I'm not this, or oh, I'm grooming Joe Smith, talk to him. I'm like, really? I interview women, hello. That's frustrating that they cancel themselves out.
Well, there's a zillion statistics on the other side, right? We were just talking about how the bylines of women at these different news organizations. There's also a real dearth of often women who are willing to talk on the record. Yep. And there's really negative statistics about that. And part of that, you, as just a real life journalist, and you're on deadline and you got to hit the deadline, you know, you want to make the calls, and I'm not making excuses, but at some point, the women just inherently are so much more unwilling to kind of talk about what happened in the meeting or go out on a limb and put their name to something than a lot of their kind of men at the same level. And I think it's this real tension we talk about all the time in our newsroom and in our coverage. And one of my big things when I took Playbook over is I wanted more female representation in who we were talking to as our sources, because I thought that was really important, as more women head offices in Washington, more women are chiefs of staff in Washington, more women are members. But it's really difficult because there's just a level of, I think, they're uncomfortable with it still.
Yeah, they're reticent to go on the record.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I also think there is a divide. I had a very interesting conversation with a few Black female, like, comms directors and chiefs of staff, and just about, there is a game that is played on the Hill, and there is, like, being part of the larger conversation does sometimes, and you may disagree with me on this, it kind of required me when I covered the Hill to sort of speak white boy. And what I mean by that is that, like, I'm married to a white man who is a huge baseball fan, right? I was not a baseball fan before I married him, because no. because I grew up in Texas and I love football and it is what it is. But here's the deal. I started listening to the conversations people would have on the sides at the Capitol or even in our studios at NBC or something. Men like to talk about baseball. And
really
what I
do.
Realized
it
was
actually that's like yeah, yes,
it's
you are
huge.
100% right.
And what I realized was I needed to start listening to my boyfriend at the time, now my husband, when he talked about baseball, so that I would know who the major players were and what went on last night and like where they are in the standings, so I could participate in the conversation. And then okay, you're participating in that conversation. Let me invite you with this other group of men who are journalists to drinks with this chief of staff. There is this game that gets played, and you have to learn to speak that language. And one day that language is going to change. But my conversation with those Black women who work on the Hill that I found interesting was they felt separated from their white colleagues as well, that they were not part of those conversations and games that they needed to play on the politics side that is sort of somewhat removed from journalism. And I basically said to them, I was like, then you got to jump in there and
exactly.
do it. Because the thing is, every once in a while, you run into a Naomi Karam or Alex Wallace, who are the two women who like helped me do big things in my career. But sometimes there's no one there to help you. And I benefited on the Hill from my correspondent at the time was Luke Russert, who I loved to death, who is such a bro in the nicest way possible. He also like kind of took my hand and helped me with some of that too. But I also, weirdly, I did the work about baseball and that helped.
So you have to bridge the gap.
You do. You have a lot of reporting, though, is finding commonality. And if you have the sources, for the most part, in leadership and at high levels are white men, or when I covered lobbyists, right? I had nothing in common with them, right? I was like, I hope my credit card was going to clear when we went. I had bad lunch. I was like, oh, it's going to be really awkward. You know, but you have to find things that, whether it was wine or whether it was food or whether it was sports, and, you know, I didn't have kids. I wasn't married. I, you know, all those things that people form relationships based on and trust you based on. A lot of the times you're trying to, like, bridge that divide.
Well, being a reporter is based on trust. I mean, yeah, and you have to build it quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
But that must have been really lonely for Miriam.
Yes. And I was just, as I'm listening to you talk, one of the things that was happening, we see the spectacle of femininity that's going on in her articles. Mm-hmm. But in the newsroom, there's a lot of conversation about the fact that she had to act like one of the guys. And there's this famous line from the journalist Elizabeth Jordan, who was an editor at Harper's, where she says, the newsroom is not a drawing room. So, I mean, that seems to still resonate.
I was interested, too, when you were talking about this, because you were talking about how her byline was everywhere. And then you go back to, like, the 70s and all these women who were working in journalism and news and all the major, you know, weekly or monthlies, they would never be, they were the copy girls and could never get a byline. So is there just a regression that happened?
Right. I think you had Good Girls Revolt, right?
Of course.
Yeah, you have the New York Times lawsuit.
And I was also curious from your experience, it sounds like there's a way in which the gendered lens seems to be implicit rather than explicit now, that you can't say, as Miriam did, this is from a woman's point of view. I'm looking at the mayor of San Francisco from one's point of view in the headline, right?
Yeah, I don't think we can really say that. But I don't want to say that in a weird way. It's not, I don't know if that's a selling point exactly. And I think in those headlines,
it
was a selling point. Yes. That's why they put her byline on there. They were like, oh, people will be interested in this.
Right.
I think the goal is like, we want to cover things because they're news, not because of the, and not because of the spectacle or because of who, you know, who I am.
Right. But I do find that a lot of women reporters make a point of covering some of these issues. For example, Stephanie Ruhle makes a point of talking about women, getting more women in monuments. Mm-hmm. This was not a reporter, but when, I forget her name, the 13-year-old girl escaped from the creepy guy who had killed her parents.
Oh, yeah.
At the news conference, all of the cops and the FBI thanked each other. And the superintendent, who's a woman, is first female to get up to talk, actually thanked the girl for escaping. And I was like, thank you, because none of their work would have mattered if she hadn't gotten herself the hell out of there. But I just thought it was really interesting that it was the woman who actually had the empathy, maybe it's empathy, to thank her, right? It's a different point of view. Do you see gender gap? You guys are entrenched in covering Trump and the Democratic candidates right now. Do you see a difference in how women cover those candidates, or any different, like, questions or perspectives or issues that they cover?
I don't exactly. I mean, I think at least the women on my team and other women that I know, especially when it comes to covering the campaigns, they're pretty much doing it the same way. I think where the differences happen are what Anna said, which is like, you did a series on sexual assault. Like, maybe there will be someone who is like, okay, let me look at Gillibrand's record and look at it from this point of view, because we know about all the stuff she has done about with sexual assault in the military. But overall, I'm not sure that part of the job can be gendered. I think story choice sometimes can be gendered.
Well, it can depend. That's what I'm talking about, story choice. But there's also, you know, are they covering, I mean, we have several women running for office right now. So are they covering the female candidates differently?
I mean, I think that's a massive discussion now, right?
Yeah.
And, like, clearly all of us and as news outlets have a responsibility to figure it out. But it's, you know, the gendered language. Are we talking, when you describe someone, are you talking, oh, an Anna wore a bright red jacket and lipstick and, you know, that would never happen. And so I think partly as an industry, when you have more women running in offices than they ever have before, you have more women running with their kind of, quote, authentic self, which means they're no longer choosing to just wear, you know, pearls and blazers and kind of all look and feel like they have to look alike. I think we saw that truly in 2018 in a way that we've never seen before. But I think as an institution and as each, you know, kind of company, we're trying to do the best we can, but sometimes, you know, there's mistakes.
Deadlines are deadlines,
But I also think that the influence of having more women in the press means that there are men who are thinking in this way.
I think
one big example of this, whether it's male or female, is, you know, we're actually all asking Beto, how does it feel to not be with your kids for this long? Like, the one big question that I had after the 2018 election, which he says, like, he basically left his wife alone with the kids for a year and a half. He very much so admitted it. But then he talked right after that about, like, I'm not going to run for president. I haven't been around for the kids. He's running for president. So you know what? One of the questions is that. We had, we were on the road. Gosh, which candidate? They're all running together. There's too many of them running. Well, with some male candidate who had kids. we have this scene where a correspondent is in the car with him and he's FaceTiming with his kids. And one of the things I will say is I have made the point before our correspondents go out of saying, everyone who has kids, you need to talk to them about what is this, because we're trying to do pieces that illuminate a little bit more about who the person is behind the scenes. Like, everyone who has kids, we need to talk to them about their kids, their partner, everything, because that is a big thing you leave behind when you run for president. Yeah. That's a big choice to make, especially if you have little babies.
It's also a reflection of how you manage that is
exactly.
A reflection of your values and how you make decisions, right?
Yeah. And I don't think it's just women asking those people those questions. I think it's also men, but I think the message has gotten out that we need to ask all of those questions of all of these candidates. That question about what are you doing with your kids is still valid for Kirsten Gillibrand, yeah. If you ask me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's valid for all of them.
Right. I remember in Geraldine Ferraro's book, she talked about how annoying it was when she'd be, talking about policy and they just talk about her shoes or her hair or something.
Yeah.
I want to segue to women voters. Women make up 53% of the electorate now, so obviously we're going to determine the election, as I said in my intro. The Washington Post said recently women may be the, quote, women may be the ones to put a stake through the Trump presidency. Anna, Trump won with 52% of the female vote, which is really interesting to me in and of itself, and Lori and I have talked about this a little bit, about this issue of women voting with their husbands, and we think that might be behind some of this. But yet, over 1 million women marched against him the day after he was elected, right? So, and he's had issues with women, .. The Politico reported last month that, quote, polls continue to show a pronounced gender gap in the president's approval rating, so he might not get that 42%. How do you see the female vote going in 2020? This may be one of your topics du jour.
So you're thinking about it, aren't you?
Yes. After the 2016 election, I got out of the prediction game. I think all journalists to get out of the prediction game.
I can't imagine why.
I use that as my baseline. But I'm happy to talk about it because I think it's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about and covering. I think a couple things. One, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what two demographics do when you talk about women and the president and just the 2020 election. I think one is 50-plus women voters, which are going to be a huge voting block, particularly in early states in Iowa and New Hampshire. And then I just literally left a conference doing a town hall with Ignite, which is a group that is nonpartisan, but it brings in young women from all across the country who are interested in running for office or being activists or different things and hearing the youth women's vote. Because in the 2018 midterms, you had younger women come out in historic numbers. And so if they keep that up, they also will be a massive part of this equation.
Is that millennials? When you say young women,
millennials. So those are kind of the two, when I break it down, those are two demographics that I'm particularly interested in and also interested in, like, what are the issues that matter to them? Because I think before you had a 50-plus voter, you're like, oh, all you have to talk about is Social Security and Medicare. And, like, we all know that that's, like, not true, yeah. Right? We, like, are still working. We're still, you're dealing with parent care. You're dealing with maybe still, you know, children who are, so there's just, it's a much more dynamic voting base that I think people can't really, just kind of count on. The other thing, and I say this a lot when I talk around the country, so this is probably going to be unpopular with this group, but I will say it anyway, which is as much as people on the coasts in New York, in D.C., in California dislike this president, there is a large group of people in the middle of the country, and there's members of Congress that represent them. When they go home, men and women are going up to them, and they're not saying, I can't believe you know, what this president's done. They're saying, why aren't you defending him more? Why aren't you hugging him more? And I just think there's a real disconnect for men and women that are supportive of this president. And as much as he has the gap that the Morning Consult political poll showed, he also has a strong base of support that has not eroded.
Yeah.
So that, I know that's unpopular here, but I just think it's an important thing for people to kind of try to wrap their brains around.
Yeah, I experienced a really big differential when I lived in extreme hot and extreme cold, Nevada and North Dakota. And I really, I mean, it's a good wake-up call. I mean, it's a very different value system, and you really learn a different culture. Are you finding any difference?
I mean, I think the thing that was very instructive for me was the 2017 special election in Alabama, the Roy Moore special election against Doug Jones, and now Senator Jones won, a Democrat in Alabama, because we did a couple of specials around that election. But truthfully, Black women showed up and voted in Alabama, and that is a big reason why Doug Jones won.
Yeah.
And so what that's sort of like the instructive lesson I've taken away from that is that as a voting bloc, there is a lot of power there, especially in southern states, but they also have to feel like someone is actually talking to them. And you're interested in their in larger issues that affect women, but also smaller issues that affect Black women. Like those conversations have to happen for the Democratic candidates, because I do think we are starting to move to a place, and I there's a part of me that thinks this is a good thing, where that vote cannot be taken for granted.
Right.
They want to be, everybody wants to be talked to. They want to be seen. That is part of why President Trump won, is people felt like they were being seen by him in the rhetoric he was using. And no matter how you feel about that rhetoric, he tapped into something. Everyone has to, all of these candidates on the Democratic side have to think about what they're tapping into. Part of why that happened in Alabama, one, Roy Moore accused pedophile, allegedly, but two, it was because there was so much like time, focus, and effort put into that state by Democrats and by, you know, even just actors, celebrities, everyone trying to make it a cause celeb, that it did boost the turnout a little bit, especially for a special election when we don't usually have special elections that's like right before Christmas,
right,
basically.
Right.
So there is a power there that will be interesting to sort of watch how that plays out in 2020.
What about, Shauna, what about female candidates? CNN has reported recently this, quote, fear of getting Hillary'd. Women voters are still haunted by 2016 as they size up the female candidates.
Okay.
Okay, real talk coming.
I understand the question and this idea of getting Hillary'd, I guess. The problem with this is I think sexism played a role in 2016. I'm not going to say it didn't. But also Clintonism played a role in 2016. Yeah. Here's the issue there. And it's that the only way place for Hillary, former Secretary Clinton, to go was down. Everyone had made up their minds about Hillary Clinton. And a lot of that had to do with her being first lady and president and President Bill Clinton and that relationship and everything that went on there and all of the baggage that came along with all the years of experience she also had. That was part of the baggage. But that situation with her, I think, is a very unique situation. The sexism part is not unique and will translate to these candidates. And the Elizabeth Warrens and the Kamala Harrises of the world are going to have to figure out how do you counter that sexism. But I think each one, we are already seeing, they are tackling this differently. But Clinton's issues are somewhat unique issues. I mean, I don't think it can be totally compared in the same way.
Yeah, we were talking in the back. I just found a Lake Research study that women still need to be liked as well as perceived as qualified, whereas men only need to be perceived as qualified.
Yeah, but I just don't know.
In presidential campaigns, I don't know if I agree with that.
Really? That was, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I guess the thing, the lesson from Clinton isn't that women aren't running. They're running more and in the presidential. They ran more in obviously 2018. I was up at another conference earlier this week and talking to Republican women, and they said that they feel like because Democrats were so successful in winning in the House, all of a sudden they have a resurgence of Republican women who are saying, oh, you know what? I don't have to wait. I'm going to primary somebody. I'm going to get up there. And so I actually think, yes, she lost, but like she created an entire, you know, kind of avenue for so many women candidates.
That's interesting, because especially considering the woman who was heading up the effort to recruit Republican women for Congress has decided not to run again herself.
Yeah, but I think I just want to push back, because that's like a little, it's like an easy talking point, and I
really
know Susan Brooks, and like, yes, she is not running. She's chosen not to run. Some people might say she shouldn't have taken the job or not. I'm not going to say that. But what I have also heard from people to say is, yeah, she's going to retire. But now, because she's not running for her own reelection, she can recruit more women, which she's been very good at doing. She can raise more money for them. I think those people, those groups that are spending a lot of time and money trying to get women Republicans elected feel like they are in such a better place than they were for 2018.
Really? That's interesting. So, by the way, we're going to open it up to questions in a few minutes. So think about your questions. And we have mics at either end. I'm in a light warp, so I can't entirely see them, but I think you can. I saw a poll. There's anybody who knows me knows that I cover climate change. And speaking of top issues for voters, climate change is one of the top three priorities for voters in the election. And in my reporting, I've noticed that women voters tend to vote more on values, and that this is something that's more important to women voters. A, are you finding that? I see your heads nodding, so perhaps you do. Vox called it a defining issue of 2020. So I'm wondering, do you think that the urgency of climate change will, A, maybe bring out more women voters or have an impact on the get out the vote effort or affect how women vote? Because there may be women who don't believe in it either. I mean, if they're supporters of Trump, they may not believe that it's a man-made thing or whatever. So what's your sway female voters? What's your take on that?
I think it's an issue for a lot of female voters because they have families and kids. I also think it's an issue for a lot of young voters thinking about this and like, what is the future that I'm going to have? And this, it seems like a very real problem that is in our face. But I will also say, I think one of the things that has happened with climate change as an issue are there are a lot of organizations with a lot of money that are pushing it as an issue, or it's putting it more in front of all voters. I mean, you like Tom Steyer.
Yeah.
You may not want Tom Steyer to run for president, but Tom Steyer has a lot of money, and he has made climate change one of the things, along with impeaching the president, but
right,
fine.
Right. Right. That's true.
He has made it one of the things where he's like, I'm going to take all this money I have, and I'm going to put ads on your TVs, and I am going to like try to make this an issue. And I think one of the things we're going to see in this election and every election going forward are these specialty groups that have a lot of money behind them from people who are worried about things, trying to affect elections in that way. And I think Steyer is sort of the easiest example that comes to my head. But I think one telling thing this week will be, does a climate change question get asked in the debates?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Someone who like helped do the debates the last time around for NBC, I am now embarrassed that we didn't ask a climate change question and the two I helped do the questions for. But there's no way they will get away asking it this time. And I think that's like the changes we're going to start to see.
That's a sea change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just came out today with a new, like a 2020 issues tracker, and the top three issues, healthcare, no surprise. Obviously already playing a big role. Climate change, the number two issue.
Really?
The number three issue that they're watching was income inequality. Mm-hmm. And those are in the Democratic primary. Those are the three kind of outstanding issues. I mean, I think clearly, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has had a powerful microphone through Twitter and other things to really create this to be something that all these candidates have to take a stand on. And really is a litmus test of, are you Green New Deal or are you not? And I don't see it winding down in the primary, certainly.
Do you think it's going to bring anybody out? It might motivate younger, like first-time voters or millennials or something?
I could see it. I've not seen any evidence of that. It's clearly, though, as Sean is saying, I mean, the fact that you have Tom Steyer probably, you know, tens of millions of dollars on this issue.
Right.
You know, but I was just with a bunch of young activists who were just saying how difficult it is to convince their own college seniors to go vote. I mean, it is just, I mean, you know, you have to go time after time after time to try to convince them. It seems less, they weren't like, oh, climate change is going to be the silver bullet that all of a sudden we're going to have, you know, massive turnout.
Or gun violence or whatever. Well, right. And every state is different for registration, so it's really annoying. So I'm glad you brought up the debate, because this is what I wanted to ask you before we open it up to questions. What are you going to watch for in the debate? So Anna, why don't you start with that? What is it that you're actually going to look for?
I think the visual of Pete Buttigieg sandwiched between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders is one thing to watch.
The optics.
Yeah, the optics of the, you know, very young, vital guy sandwiched between the two oldest candidates. I think like how that plays a part. I think that's super interesting. I think Elizabeth Warren's clearly having her surge right now. I think that will be very interesting on the first night. So those are kind of the two things that I think will be pretty interesting to see.
Shauna, what are you going to watch for?
Who makes it clear that the race they're running is about attacking Donald Trump versus who makes it clear that the race they're running is about attacking their fellow Democrats? And that's because I think Joe Biden right now is running a race. He's running a general election race right now.
Mm-hmm. Smart or not, we don't know.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Yes.
We'll find out because there will be literally voting.
It's funny how that happens.
But whether how people engage with that, because the thing that I'm sure you've heard on the trail a lot and my team has heard on the trail a lot is that you ask them about each candidate and you go to all these events in Iowa, and by the end of the conversation with voters, it's like, but really all I care about, at least with Democratic voters, is beating Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And we've been struggling a lot at Vice right now to try to figure out, like, how do you talk about electability? What actually is electability? It's a word we throw around on cable news a lot. Like, this person's electable, this person isn't. We don't really know what that is. And our running theory now is electability is what you think your neighbor is going to do. That you think, like, whoever you think your neighbor is going to vote for, that's the person that's electable. And everyone's trying to figure out who their neighbor is going to vote for on the Democratic side. And I'm just interested to see, because it'll become very clear very quickly in each debate what each candidate's team has decided their direction to go on this. Do I keep focusing on Donald Trump, or do I focus on, like, Joe Biden's old and Bernie's a socialist and, like, Kamala's a female former DA? Like, what do they decide to do with it?
Lori,
what are you looking for, though?
Yeah.
Are you going to watch the debate? Can I talk about history?
You can stand up and get questions lined up. But what are your closing thoughts on how women journalists covering the election and covering the debates and this sea change, as they point out? I mean, we have 5 women running for president of the United States, viable female candidates being taken seriously and in fact surging in, you know, many polls. So what can we learn from history that about the impact of women journalists and going forward?
So in preparation for being in conversation with Anna and Sean, I was thinking a lot about this famous quote that journalism is the first draft of history. It's usually attributed to Philip Graham at the Washington Post. And when we think about that, right, that journalism isn't just impacting our current moment, but it's going to impact the way we see our current moment in the future, right? It's shaping the narrative that historians and scholars are creating about the past. And I think even more so, it's therefore important that we have a diverse range of voices, including women's voices, covering, you know, events right now. And so what we talked a little bit about the story about how when I first started reading Miriam's work, it was quite shocking to me because it differed so dramatically from the version of progressive era history that I got in my high school history textbook. Mm-hmm. One of the first articles that Miriam published was an interview with a transgender man. This is in 1894.
Wow.
So as a woman, she's just seeing the world so differently.
He revealed that he was transgender.
He had been arrested for cross-dressing, and she went and did an interview with him.
Wow.
And she, you know, she's writing about Mary Ellen Pleasant, who was a very prominent Black woman in San Francisco. She's writing about well-known figures like Emma Goldman. So you're really seeing history, this moment in history, through a different lens when you're seeing it through a woman's lens. And it really brings home how important that gendered lens is to the way we consume current events.
It's story choice again.
Exactly.
Story choice. So we're really glad they're doing that. So we're going to open up for questions. Eleanor Clift is one of the fabulous people who reviewed Lori's book. That's Lori's book, by the way. Full disclosure, I wrote the foreword to it, so I'm biased. But this is a great quote from Eleanor's review, and so she's here to ask her own question.
I wanted to go back to Lori and ask you how you found Miriam.
That's a great question.
How was that process of coming upon her?
Sure.
And then I wanted to ask Joan, how could your family have lost track? If I had a great-great aunt who accomplished what she did, there'd be a shrine in my house. So, anyway, if you could.
Well, it's become a shrine in my house.
I discovered her, it came out of my first book. My first book, one of the women that I wrote about in that book was Edna Ferber, a very popular writer, best known for Showboat. And in Edna Ferber's autobiography, she says that the way that she got into writing was by reading Miriam Michelson's stories in the Saturday Evening Post. And Edna Ferber also began as a journalist and then became a novelist. And I had never heard of Miriam Michelson, but luckily this was the moment of digitization. And as soon as I Googled, her stories came up and I began to read them, and that just went forward from there.
And somehow she found me, and the rest, as we say, is history. Hi.
Thank you so much for this really engaging discussion. I have a question about the abortion debate. It seems to me that with a lot of conservative victories in some of the southern states, there should be a level of backlash, especially among young women, that we are likely to see during the 2020 elections. I'm asking about your opinion on the issue. And is the abortion debate going to be a major part of the conversation during this presidential moment?
Yeah, it is.
Especially with Planned Parenthood.
It is, and I think Senator Gillibrand has really seized upon this issue, and I think a lot of the other female candidates are in some ways seizing upon the issue. But it is a motivating issue for some people, but it is one of those things that motivates on both sides.
Yeah.
So especially when we get to like general election mode, you have to remember there are a lot of people in a lot of like conservative states that vote on abortion. This is the thing. They are not pro-life or anti-choice or whichever term I'm supposed to be using right now. And they feel very strongly about it. And so it is one of those issues that like ignites people really on both sides. So yes, it'll be an issue, but it's not necessarily an issue that's just benefiting one side.
Yeah, I agree with you. The only thing I would say is I think what's going to be really interesting is I think on the right, it has been a clearly motivating factor for general elections. On the left, less so. And so the question I have is, there's going to be a ton of money that's going to be spent pushing both sides of this debate throughout the primary and through the general. Is, does the left find this as a real motive? Can they use it as a motivating factor?
Well, the administration has been chipping away at women's reproductive health and rights, and the closing of the Mississippi Clinic, and I think Texas is down to one. I mean, there's just been taking away, you know, canceling Roe versus Wade one bite at a time, basically. So I think that's been very motivating.
But I would say that's what their supporters want them to do.
Well,
I would say that it's...
But I'm talking about on the other side to motivate the pro-choice,
Historically, it hasn't been as motivating of a factor.
See, that's really
interesting. On the Democratic side.
Hi.
Good evening. Thank you so much. I'm Lucy Getman with Women in Government. We work with women state legislators and other political leaders at the state level. So what do you think will happen in 2020? Will we continue to see this growing percentage of women state legislators and other political leaders, or as you're out and about in the states, is this going to be a one-cycle phenomenon?
I don't have a good idea. I think you will see a growing amount, because I do think there was an energy that happened after President Trump, and most of that energy happened on the Democratic side. And in 2018, I definitely kept asking people on my team to, like, we should do more work about women on the Republican side running for office. Like, we knew what that groundswell looked like on the Democratic side. Turned out there wasn't as many women on the Republican side running for office. I think you will see a lot more of that. And I think we saw a lot of women win in state houses, actually, in state legislative races in 2018. I think that will continue.
I also think on the Republican side, you saw on a lot of the districts that House Republicans won and that are the moderates. I mean, if you really look at it, there's probably 22 really competitive seats in the House. A lot of the Republicans who lost in those moderate suburban districts were Republican women. And so you had their ranks go from, I believe, 23 to 13, which is really the historic low after the 2018 cycle. But part of that was the canceling out of some of the women that lost in those races. But I do think in every source I've been talking to on the Republican side, they believe there will be more Republican candidates. I think the issue for them oftentimes is getting through the primary. I think you're seeing that, I don't know how close you guys are following this in North Carolina. It's a big issue right now, where there's an open seat after a death of a congressman, where there's a doctor who's a woman who's running versus a state House representative. And every single Republican woman in the House and Senate have endorsed the woman.
Wow.
But Mark Meadows of the Freedom Caucus has endorsed the state senator. And so this is a big issue, but you have a lot of outside groups now for the first time on the Republican side that are playing and backing Republican women, because that's why Elise Stefanik, her big issue out of New York, is to try to get some of these people elected.
Hi.
Hello. My name is Mark Hannis, and I'm helping co-found an organization called Inclusive America to increase diversity, especially in the executive branch, There's three cabinet positions we've never had a woman in. There's ambassador to Israel or Germany we've never had a woman in. And so in other countries, they create like a chief diversity or inclusion officer. We see this in Fortune.
Don't count on it in the Trump administration.
Not this one. Or in other countries, there are quotas or targets. And I was curious what your thoughts are on either of those being something that the future president could do.
Well, the Obama administration had the Office of Women and Girls that Valerie Jarrett headed up, and they, I mean, I correct me if I'm wrong, but her job was really to make sure that women were represented and women's points of view were represented in every aspect of the decision-making process across the agencies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily see the idea of someone creating a chief inclusion officer. I think the interesting thing is like, how, especially if we're going to talk about presidential candidates, does that question come up with them? So not like, are you going to create an inclusion officer, but how are you thinking about creating your cabinet? And whether that idea, and I do think some of those ideas of diversity, especially if we have, as we have these conversations about reparations and other stuff, which are questions that I don't remember anyone asking Barack Obama about in 2008 or 2012, that as part of those conversations and as a part of all of these different forums from different types of organizations, like, what does your cabinet look like?
Yeah.
That is the question I think we have to ask the presidential
That's
candidates.
That's a great question.
But I don't think, I don't see quotas going anywhere because no one's gonna want to say, I promise to do 50-50 because they don't want you to take, they don't know what their choices are going to be. They don't know what they're going to actually do once they get there. But how much are you thinking about this? That is illuminating in the conversation.
I think you can look at least their staff that they currently have, right? You're having more women in senior positions in a lot of these different campaigns. Oftentimes they aren't the number one campaign manager yet. But I do think that there is a big effort, particularly on the Democratic side, to get more women, more inclusive in a broader than just gender way to have the staffs, you know, really representative.
And not to take away from them, they know the press is looking at that.
Of course. Yeah. Like,
and what roles they're in,
who are in those
too.
Roles.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, all roles are not created equal. Hi.
Hi. Miriam Vogel, Executive Director of Equal AI.
Oh, hi.
I wanted to thank you all for doing this panel and helping us take stock at this seminal moment of where we've been and where we're going, and particularly Joan for organizing it. I, as Joan knows, work on unconscious bias in AI, which sometimes is a bleak vision of the world and where we're going. And I'm wondering what your vantage point is of our trends from your workplaces and from the people you're covering in workplaces. How is it looking for women and minorities? Are we going to have our daughters covering these same stories?
Lori, what are the professorships like at Boston College?
Is this a question about how things have not changed over time?
I'm wondering, looking forward, our trajectory.
I thought you were asking, like, what's the makeup, what's the gender and ethnicity, what's the
I'm
diversity
wondering how we're
breakdown
trending.
Now?
Is it getting better? Are we looking? Are we going to have a brighter
future
for women? I'm optimistic.
I think I mean, it's pretty easy to be cynical in this world. So I'm going to be optimistic on this issue.
Well, you work somewhere that's 52% female.
Yeah,
so
and just I do think that just in the sense of like, even starting in journalism here, you know, I wouldn't even think about having these kind of conversations when I started covering this in Washington. Right, I wouldn't want to be considered different. I wouldn't want to be thinking. You know, there's a lot of. One of the things I think we've really seen on the Hill is the number of women journalists who will tweet or talk to reporters and tell their stories of harassment or inappropriate behavior that I don't know if it was just a different time or maybe I was not willing to share my story for different reasons, but I would never have the confidence at 24 to talk about that and say, you know, no, shame on you, like member X, this is not appropriate. And I just think there's conversations like that, and there's so much more awareness.
Yeah. I think we're moving in the right direction. Okay. You know, I have a team that probably has more female producers than male. I mean, our show, Vice News Tonight, as a whole, one of our executive producers is a woman. Incredible diversity, actually. And I think the more you bring that into the fold, the more people will look out and see, hey, I can do this job, and it will bring more people who have more diverse points of view. I have a whole spiel about this, but I actually think one of the bigger questions for journalism, at least, is the socioeconomic divide. And this idea of bringing in people who have different, like come from different levels of socioeconomic up, down, whatever, so that that point of view is represented and that journalism in both TV and print and digital, the first jobs one gets in journalism pay really terribly. And I've said this before, and I got into a fight with a New York Times editor about this, but I'm going to say it again.
Doubling down.
The issue is, if you are in both my parents went to college, grew up in the South. They both grew up poor, but they both went to college. My mother has a master's degree, almost had a PhD until I came along. And both of them, literally, until I introduced them to Barack Obama at a White House Christmas party, which at that point was like 8 or 9 years into my career, kept asking me, when was I going to go to law school? And where that came from was, they are African Americans who wanted me to be secure, and that they knew I could be secure. It's not that they ever like discouraged me from going into news. It was just like, when are you going to do that real thing? And then we'll know you'll be okay. And I think you see that play out in immigrant communities, especially, who are like, you need to be a doctor or a lawyer, go do it. I think you see it play out in minority communities. And what that does is, I think it keeps people from choosing this life. And I grew up upper middle class. Like, my parents did well. But so I'm not necessarily bringing like someone who grew up in poverty to the newsroom, but I am bringing an awareness that part of the reason why these jobs don't lend themselves to people who did grow up in poverty or did grow up as like first generation immigrants or something like that is because the jobs don't pay that well at the beginning. And so you don't feel comfortable. Your family doesn't feel comfortable. You do not want to disappoint your family. You do not go into it. Well, and I actually think that's one of the things we have to work on, so that those different points of view will be there. And I've thought a lot about it since Trump took office, because I think there was something that middle of the country thing. We don't have enough people around us saying we need to do this story and this story and this story.
Well, talking to their mom at home and saying, you know,
exactly.
Coming
up. What Lori was talking about with the first draft of history. I mean, if you have different points of view covering the stories, you have a different history then gets reported differently,
exactly.
Right? And I also think that living in different parts of the country makes a difference. I mean, I've lived in 8 or 9 states. Yep. And so, I mean, you know, New York, California, North Dakota, Nevada, et cetera, Tennessee. I mean, talk about different. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Lindsay Mask from Ladies America. And I had two recent podcasts that I listened to, and the subject matter was so interesting to me that I was just interested to see what you thought, or if you'd given any thought to these. One being a female reporter really analyzing her source list and realizing it was all white men. And it was really disjointing to her because it wasn't even a realization that that was the source list. So that's one. You can do multiple choice if you want. And the second one is how few women, and particularly women of color, are investing in or contributing to political campaigns, and that the alternative generally for women was found in this research was they're giving to nonprofits, their community, and or they believe that supporting a candidate means actively liking their page or reposting their post, but not putting money towards it, and that there is a distinction between this, that they're women that are actually putting money towards it, over $500, are finding access that they didn't otherwise find. And really, I've been involved in politics for so long, and it just struck me, like, I don't do this either. I probably do the latter.
Yeah, I'll take both, but I'm going to go fast on the first one, which is, yes, I think that most people in Washington, if they were honest and looked at their source list, would say the majority are white men. I think largely because that has historically been the people who've been in power, right, behind the scenes in particular. And so I think we all need to do better. And I think being head of Women Rule has really been illuminating to me, because we just did an event, for example, for the 116th Salute to the Women Chiefs of Staff, and the number of women that are chiefs of staff that are in powerful positions. And it's just really like having to make an effort, I think. And that's on me, and that's on, I think, reporters in general. On your second point, which is something I focus on a ton with Women Rule, which is about women running for office and women and fundraising. And I think what you said is absolutely true. Most women consider it more of charity activities. That's how they get involved, and they want to write checks. I think that's one of the biggest reasons why women don't run for office, whenever you talk to them, is because they don't want to have to ask anybody for money. They are very active in their communities. They're very active on their school board or with the symphony in their town, and they have no problem asking for people to contribute to that. But they have a lot harder time doing the reverse of that, which is to say, I'm the commodity, I'm selling myself. And so I think there's a real kind of relationship there in terms of being comfortable asking for the money and then also cutting the checks. Because they also probably haven't necessarily been asked as much as you might think to like actually contribute.
Good point.
Interesting. Hi, Donna.
Hi, I'm Donna Selden. Thank you. This has been the most amazing panel, so I really appreciate being here. I'm a little bit of a follow-on to that because I'm part of a group called Resisterhood, and we're working on a documentary, and we're trying to do energize women to participate, vote, and contribute. And I don't know, it still feels like a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. Like, do you see, I know that I hang around with a lot of women and we're energized, right? We're active and we're excited and we're pumped up to, you know, do something. But I still run into many women that are like, oh, I'm so glad you marched, but they would never consider marching. Like, I just feel like there's still a lot of women that don't participate. And I don't know how to help motivate that. I don't know if you see women's groups around the country and they really are energizing volumes of people.
I mean, I think there definitely was an energy from 2018 and how that carries itself out. I think because so many women won and they won for the first time, it is sort of on them also to re-energize people around them. But I also think, I mean, there are a lot of men who don't pay any attention too. There's a lot of people who don't vote. And I think that is less a factor of male or female and more a factor of sometimes it's us as journalists, sometimes it's politicians, sometimes it's organizations, of not communicating well what your vote actually means and what that translates to.
And I'll just say, being on a college campus, I don't know what age group you're talking about, but certainly younger women seem quite energized in a way that I have not seen in my years in academia.
Really? So, this year is different.
I think since the last
election. Since Trump or since 18?
Since Trump.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Great.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, good. This is perfect timing because we're in timeout. That's very exciting. So I want to close with a quote from the renowned journalist Soledad O'Brien, who also wrote a terrific review of Lori's book about Miriam Michelson. Quote, "This is a strong reminder that women worked hard for the right to tell the stories of our nation in their own voice. I am humbled by the women who came before me as I read about their struggles and perseverance, especially today, as so many women fight for recognition and respect. It is important to look back at the long road we have already traveled and gain strength." So thank you very much for being here tonight. Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Shauna. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you,
Thank you very much. Thank you to the museum for your hospitality. Thank you for being a terrific audience and for your great questions. Lori and I will be upstairs at the bookstore signing books in a couple of minutes, whenever we get through the maze of this building. And you can find us in all these places. It's on Twitter. Anna and Sean are major Twitter people. I'm not too shabby, but they have it. Lori's at Boston College. By the way, anybody who's watching this online, on live stream, we're taking this show on the road to a degree. Lori and I are in different cities around the country around the commemoration of the 19th Amendment. It's on both my website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and Lori's as they pop up. So we've got a bunch of cities booked around the country. And I have a more in-depth interview with Lori on my podcast about also the Me Too movement around, or the version of it, around the suffragists. And how the women journalists dealt with their own Me Too movement. And it's really interesting, as well as more about Aunt Miriam, who I'm excited to know about. So if you do reach out, by the way, please tell me that you were here and came here and give me your feedback. And in case we don't see you upstairs, thank you for being here. Have a lovely evening.
Check out some podcasts from one of our new sponsors. About a dozen great shows focused on lifestyle industries on Mouth Media Network, with top brand executives, industry leaders, and innovators in fashion, beauty, travel, real estate, content creation, and even spirituality industries and more. Check out Mouth Media Network, powered by Sennheiser, on iTunes, Google Play, and at mouthmedianetwork.com.